welcome to House of Comments. I'm Charlotte Henry, and she is Emma Bunnell.
Hello.
So, it's been a big week, not particularly in Westminster, but over in Belfast, because Stormont power sharing has resumed. We should sort of put this in context, right? There has been no power sharing in Stormont, essentially no Northern Ireland Assembly, no Northern Ireland Executive, for 2 years, which is pretty staggering and obviously very concerning. It's sort of civil service servants have kept the show on, though, because the DUP refused power sharing for various reasons, which we'll get into. Now, you and I should put a disclaimer at the start of this. Both you and I are fascinated by politics of Northern Ireland, but would never claim to be experts in the intricacies of the six counties.
I think
counties.
We know a little bit more than previous Northern Ireland secretary. I think it was Michelle Donnellan who said, oh, I didn't know sectarianism was a thing.
Yeah, that wasn't a good moment. Yeah, that was it. That was not a good moment, no. But we will return to today. Chris Eden-Harris is now the Northern Ireland Secretary and seems to have got, eventually, the show on the road, which I think is good progress. But, of course, one of the big things we should be, and I apologise, Emma, because when we took on this show, when we revamped it, it was over a year ago now, a year and a bit, you said, but I can't talk about Brexit, Charlotte. We did it too much. It was painful. And I happily agreed. But unfortunately, everything in Northern Ireland has come as a result of Brexit, because whoever could have seen that Brexit would cause a problem on the island of Ireland? That was very
Absolutely.
Hard to predict, wasn't it?
Apart from everyone who
apart from
it.
Literally John Major and Tony Blair standing in Northern Ireland saying this might be a problem, lads.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, Brexit, whilst it has an awful lot of emotive campaigning around it, is ultimately about trade deals and borders. And the border between Ireland as in ERA and Northern Ireland, part of the United Kingdom, two separate countries, was for decades completely porous, because it could be, because that's how our relationship with the European Union worked.
And we should say, from my, again, not very much not perfect understanding, but you look at it and you're like, it's a classic fudge that sort of helps everyone, because there's no border on the island of Ireland, which Republicans like, which people that want an independent island can sort of, it's not perfect, but they can sort of get along because they're moving freely across the island of Ireland. And people did that for work every day, from what I understand, would move from across one bit to the other, and it didn't really matter. And obviously, unionists were happy because they were still part of the United Kingdom. And everyone sort of mucked in and got around it. There was obviously the Good Friday Agreement, a huge political achievement of the last Labour government. And it also, so it meant everyone could muck around. And the proof of the pudding was in the eating, right? There was a huge reduction in violence in Northern Ireland.
Yes, absolutely. And all of this was only possible because of that porous border.
Yes, that's exactly my point. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Which, as soon as we said that we would have borders with the EU, that obviously meant some sort of notion of a border with between ERA, Ireland, who stayed a member of the EU, and the UK, which left.
And it had to be that way, because there was a had to be a land border between the EU and the United Kingdom.
Yes.
It could never be any other way. If you were going to obsess about, you know, for the borders and all that stuff that we went through and the various prime ministers trying to get deals done and the Tory backbenchers insisting on those things, it was always going to end up, there had to be something either in the Irish Sea, which doesn't please unionists, or cutting off, there had to be a border with all the checks and that required, on the island of Ireland, a land border.
Which is just completely impractical because there are so many businesses based along that border that literally just cross it on a, you know, not just a daily, but an hourly basis.
Indeed.
So ultimately, unionists who don't want any divergence from Britain had to live with Boris Johnson going, there'll be no divergence from Britain, except for this big border we're putting down the Irish Sea. And that's what ultimately led to them leaving Stormont. I might be cynical, but I think the fact that it happened at the moment that they also elected a...
Sorry, by there you mean the DUP?
No, Northern Ireland at the same time elected their first ever Sinn Féin
first minister.
And all of a sudden the DUP went and threw their toys out the pram. So lots of things happened concurrently that made it more politically easy for the DUP to go, we're not playing, we're taking our toys home.
Sure.
But what this does mean is that if Stormont reopens tomorrow as expected, there will
I assume
be
you mean, Monday when not...
No, I think there's supposed to be a special sitting on Saturday.
Blimey.
I think that's what I read in Playbook this morning. There will be, for the first time ever, a Sinn Féin First Minister in the Stormont Assembly.
Yes.
They will not be supported
which
by
which shouldn't blaze past the significance of that moment.
No, absolutely. It's an enormous thing. You know, ultimately, what it means... And it could be even more enormous because there's an election in Ireland this year and Sinn Féin are leading in the polls. You could then have Republicans and people who wish to reunite the island of Ireland in charge of both parts of the island of Ireland. That's not happened before, you know, for well over 100 years.
Yeah.
And will have very, very significant effects if there then becomes, as might be triggered by the Good Friday Agreement, a cross-border poll as to whether reunification happens.
Yeah.
The Conservative and Unionist Party, in their desperation for Brexit, may well be the people to break up the union. And the conversation that all of us have been having for 20 years about how the union might break up ain't going to be Scotland for who goes first.
No, actually, we will be coming to Scotland a little bit later in the show after the dramatic scenes there. But to stay with Northern Ireland, it is quite extraordinary that no one in the... that's not quite true, because people did tell... Some people in the Conservative and Unionist Party did warn that this would happen. Even Theresa May and her infamous backstop tried to stop the complete apocalypse that could happen. That was part of what her aim was. But... For me, in some ways, the most important thing is the impracticality of what this imposed on people on both sides of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. Because, as you rightly pointed out, there were businesses completely based on moving across this non-existent border, day in, day out, hour in, hour out.
And as I understand it, a lot of these businesses are based on produce that has quite a short shelf life. So there's a lot of dairy stuff that would just mean that kind of constant delays and checks would make them completely financially unviable.
So the thing that seems to have got things moving both practically and metaphorically is the removal of these routine checks. That seems to have shifted the dial a bit.
But what that means is that Northern Ireland, at the very least, will have no divergence from the EU.
Which, of course, the DUP were a hard Brexit party.
DUP are a hard Brexit party. And also, no divergence from the EU in Northern Ireland might again mean Northern Ireland diverging from
the rest of the
UK if we do decide to diverge from European standards. Now, frankly, if, as it seems likely, we get a Labour government, that's less likely than it is under a Tory government. Labour have said that they are likely to move closer to the EU in terms of things like agricultural standards, not move closer to, but not diverge rather, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of keep things as they were.
Yeah, which is the sort of thing that might have particularly messed with the Northern Irish economy. So if we get a Labour government in the UK, they will probably be able, it won't be such a big problem because they'll be less seeking to do all of the divergence on standards, environmental and workers' rights, sure, that the Tories would be seeking to do.
Yeah, that may well be right. It's interesting, there wasn't sort of cheering and confetti in the House of Commons as this was debated. There's quite a lot of nervousness from different sides in different ways.
Well, I think it's a tough needle to have thread.
Correct.
And I wouldn't celebrate it now. I think get it over the line, let it happen, let it bed in before anyone gets celebratory.
Yes, I think that's right. I'm just talking about the way MPs were sort of responding. There wasn't a general consensus of, well done, this is all great.
No, and I think to be fair, we should give some credit to both Sunak and Heaton Harris, who have clearly prioritised this,
yes,
and worked very hard on making it work. I'm not, as you know, a big fan of Rishi Sunak's approach to almost anything, but on the Windsor framework and this, which has come out of the Windsor framework, I think he's done a good job, and I'm willing to say that.
Yeah. Well, and it, as you say, it is a difficult needle to thread. And therefore, to have got anything moving forward, just to have politicians sitting in Stormont again, acting as the Assembly and the Executive, is a genuine achievement and really important for the UK. I think for the United Kingdom in general, it's important.
Yes.
You can't have this sort of one part that is not governed.
That's not democratic, really.
It's not democratic. That's not fully governed in the way that was designed.
And everything's been held up there for so long,
exactly,
because no political decision making could be made. So it was just a continuation. And that continuation happened during 2 years where the world has changed quite a lot.
Just a bit, yeah. So as you said, we're hoping the Assembly will meet on Saturday. And I was getting confused because it's the Executive that's expected to meet on Monday.
Yeah.
But you were right that the Assembly is to meet on Saturday. All very significant moments. So, you know, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson himself, who's the leader of the DUP, saying that it's not perfect, the deal, but, and one issue he raised was veterinary medicines. That's obviously an ongoing issue. So we're going to have to keep an eye on this, as we always do in the intricate politics of Northern Ireland. But I think that you're right to praise the politicians, frankly, from all, you know, all the parties that sort of got something moving. And, you know, hopefully we'll see a sort of democratic functioning politics in Northern Ireland again, because it really matters. It matters to peace on the island of Ireland. It matters to peace in the UK. And it matters as a point of principle as well. So hopefully this is the start of things being positive and moving forward. Let's head to another part of the United Kingdom, Scotland. The travelling roadshow of the COVID inquiry headed there, I always try and play this down. I don't like to do it as sort of must-watch TV, but it was quite dramatic, Nicola Sturgeon's appearance there. I spent a bit of time watching it and was sort of drawn in to it. I think I could repeat almost everything we've said about the COVID inquiry entirely. You know, it wasn't politicians that killed people. It was a horrible virus that killed people. We need to look at stuff wider than should we have locked down harder, faster. I could repeat all of that, but I won't, because there was some very specific things to do with Nicola Sturgeon that we should unpack, which was, she was questioned quite hard on this idea that she politicised her response to COVID to try and get one. I got the impression they basically meant get one up on the UK government.
Yeah, I mean, it was classic SNP. If Westminster's doing X, we have to do Y because we're not Westminster.
It felt like that to me at the time, I have to say.
Yeah.
And she denied all of that.
And more than that, it was, it may well be that they wanted to do things differently, and that's fine. That's what devolution is for and about.
Indeed.
Totally in favour of that. But I think it was the framing of their thinking rather than the framing of the presentation that is worrying. Did they make decisions based on the needs of Scottish health, or did they make decisions based on their desire for independence? And if everything you do just comes back to independence, you are not a government, you're a single issue party.
Not even a single issue party, you're a single issue campaign organisation, because you're not even trying to run things more broadly.
No, and I think this is where the SNP, the wheels are really, really falling off. The wheels fell off in part because of the ongoing financial scandal, sure, to which we don't yet have legal answers. But it seems that the political answer is largely the SNP believes that any money that was given towards any independence campaign
is their money,
can be spent on the SNP because the SNP is independence and independence is the SNP. And of course, legally, that's not necessarily, although we haven't yet had any charges in the case, the same thing.
Yeah, we should emphasise that is an ongoing
police
case.
Investigation. There haven't been any charges. There have been arrests, but not charges. So we don't know what's happening there.
No, and that will all unfold. I found, as I said, let's go back to Sturgeon's appearance in particular. Obviously, at some point, she was quite emotional.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I know.
I knew you weren't going to like this.
Boris Johnson did the same thing. He got all emotional. Both of them got emotional, not about all the people who died, but about the impact it had on themselves. And I'm just sorry, that's not a good look to me.
No.
Oh, it was so hard being First Minister under that crisis.
It is an interesting.
Terrible. I apologise to any of our Scottish listeners for that.
Yeah, we've now lost every listener in Scotland. I'm not editing that out because you can get all the rude letters.
I have a friend who's called Katrina, and she's a PPC in Scotland, and her friends call me London Katrina because I reckon we're so alike, but I would point out that we're clearly not alike in accent.
Not in the accent. So I thought, I know what you mean about that. And dare I say, and I'm sorry to say this, but it's true. I think it particularly doesn't help when it's a female leader because it is just used to bash women, all that, oh, so emotional, can't lead, blah, 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 blah. I know that's not right that I should feel like that, but it did make me feel like that a bit.
It's just look.
I do have a level.
I don't think a woman should be more hard faced than Boris Johnson is forced to be. I just don't think either of them.
No, but that's the reality. We know what the reality
are engendering
is.
Sympathy.
Yes.
When the thing that has brought them to tears is not the people they are there to represent, but themselves doing the job.
Yes. Now, I think we have to have a level of empathy and even sympathy with how horrifically difficult that must have been.
Absolutely. Don't get me wrong. Absolutely.
And the human toll that must have taken.
I would imagine that they've done a lot of their crying over that. And that they are now crying because they're being asked about it is a different question again.
Yeah. Okay. Some of the things she said I found in... I want to go back really to this point of the politicization. Easy for you to say.
Politicization. What's easy for me to say? Yeah.
That one. Because it
sorry,
did
Charlotte.
It did always feel to me that she was slight... You know, there was classic things. Oh, England was going to impose restrictions on X date. Scotland's going to do it 2 days earlier. Scotland's going to come out of restrictions a week later. There always seemed to be a divergence for the sake of divergence. That's how it felt to me.
I mean, some of that divergence might have been perfectly sensible, to be fair.
But it always felt like...
But the fact that it was... It kind of felt like it was every time we're going to do it slightly differently.
Exactly.
Did feel a little tokenistic. Should we have gone into lockdown earlier? Yeah, probably. We would have been in there a lot less long if we had, quite possibly. But Scotland has quite different health needs and health profile from the UK, mm-hmm. The rest of the UK, sorry. And as such, I don't think that making different decisions for the health of their nation is wrong. But as you say, I think it could have been, rather than just being we're the goodies, England are the baddies.
Exactly.
Framing, I think more explanation as to why they were doing things differently would have been helpful.
Yes. And, you know, there was also the thing, you know, timing of press conferences when England's, when, you know, the UK government stopped doing daily ones for not totally unreasonable reasons. Sturgeon kept going.
Mm.
She often tried to time it so she was ahead, as I recall. It felt like she was playing a game to me. She's obviously denied it extensively in this session. That's how it always felt to me at the time. Forgive me for getting techie on this show. But I want to talk about WhatsApp.
Yeah.
Because this seems to be a recurring theme that no one can keep hold of their messages. Now,
well, they also don't seem to realise that those messages go to other people who do keep hold of them.
Yeah. And I appreciate, again, look, WhatsApp is end-to-end encrypted, right? So there shouldn't be access points anyway. If they're worried about it from points of security, that shouldn't really make a difference because this is end-to-end encrypted. I know that, you know, that's how it's designed. It's not like it's not a Telegram or a Signal or stuff where people feel it's even safer, but it is end-to-end encrypted and has always been as such. But I think I saw Alistair Jack saying he deleted messages for the sake of storage. I mean, this is nonsense.
Yeah, absolute nonsense.
And I'm not picking on Sturgeon or Alistair Jack because they've all done it. We've heard Rishi Sunak's messages disappear. I think didn't the whole Boris Johnson phone disappear?
I think he got a new phone because
his old
phone number was
it was on a campaign leaflet. Yes.
And Pop Bitch found it and rang it and it was him.
That's right. I mean, I'm sorry, in this day and age, this is not acceptable. I don't expect every piece of government business to be done on a formal piece of paper that can then go into the archives. They should be operating digitally, but that comes with responsibility to store stuff properly. And there does seem to be a sort of everything becoming a bit more informal by using WhatsApp, because they're sort of doing it the same as texting friends. And there has to be some responsibility for this, because data collection and archiving in government matters. Sorry to be a bore, sorry to be a nerd, but it does matter. We've seen over COVID why it matters.
Well, and it matters for democracy. It matters because we elect these people and we need to know how and why they're making decisions. Now, there needs to be space where people can spitball ideas that are mental with each other without every single one of those being leaked as if it was going to be government policy.
Quite right.
But that doesn't have to be the same as we don't get to see anything.
And it's not the same as only cabinet minutes matter.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Particularly when cabinet's barely meeting. Government has almost completely been abandoned anyway.
I mean, that happened in the Blair, you know,
it's been ongoing for decades.
So for government.
But the idea that...
So for cabinet, wasn't it?
That cabinet is the ultimate decision-making body. It's for the birds and has been for such a long time. We don't talk about ex-cabinet minister has made this decision in the same way. We maybe do it with a chancellor. So, for example, in Labour, we talk about Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves and maybe the tensions between them. We did it with Gordon Brown and Tony Blair. We did it with... Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss is a really obvious example. So maybe the top two, but when we go, oh yeah, the Tory government's going to do this on immigration or that on education or this on health, we never say, I don't even know who the current health secretary is. Is it Steve Barclay?
Actually, this is very funny. It isn't Steve Barclay. There was a clip on another politics podcast in which George Osborne, I think it was said the same thing.
Yeah. It's like, we know that they're completely pointless and are marching their way to the end of the government. So why learn them?
By the way, it's Victoria Atkins is the House Secretary.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I have seen her on various politics shows. She clearly made a deep impression.
Well, we could go into that, but let's keep with Nicola Sturgeon and what this means for her. Because she's gone from being the all-powerful to being arrested, as we talked about just a little bit a minute ago, and to have being pulled, like every other politician, being pulled over the coals, over COVID, as she was meant to be, quote-unquote, one of the good ones. And it is a rather ignominious end to her political career, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's a shame because she was a, you know, for her, she was a very, very kind of commanding senior politician for a very long time.
Say the quiet part out loud. She was a senior, very powerful female politician.
Yes. And she also saw off her previous mentor with whom she fell out, Alex Salmond. So she kind of seemed to be passing her way through this kind of seniority pretty well.
I mean, there were points where she felt unassailable.
Yeah. But that didn't last. I mean, I think.
It
never does. And I think the problem I have here.
Yes.
I'm trying to reach my problem. The problem is all politicians, when they're at the top, think they're unassailable forever, and none of them ever are. And it seems the longer and the more you feel unassailable, the lower you fall afterwards.
I think there's lots of examples of that, yes.
So it feels like there's quite a real example of
Well, the higher you go, the harder you fall, don't you?
Yeah, and I mean, it's classic UK politics. The more you get put on a pedestal, the more we're likely to knock you off it and really knock you off it. To kick you as you fall to the ground. I wonder what happens to people. This is a thing, I think. When they reach that level of seeming invincibility, she clearly started, or is certainly alleged to have started, taking a great many risks that, looked at from the outside, seem mad and stupid.
For example?
Well, I wonder all of the financial stuff.
Again,
the motorhome.
Yeah, again, we have to be really careful because it's an ongoing police investigation. But
which is why I said seemingly. We don't know what, but like...
But the point is, whatever comes out of it...
Whatever else has happened, there's a motorhome that was bought with SNP money. Now, whether that turns out to be something that's entirely legitimately done, whether it's something that is questionable but not illegal, it's a bloody great big symbol of, I don't think anyone's really going to question me.
And the fact, you know, it was her husband who was the sort of finance chief. It showed her consolidation of power within the party.
Yes. And of course, what that left was a great big vacuum, so that when she stepped down quicker than expected, that vacuum got a name in Humza Yousaf, but it's still a bloody vacuum. And the other thing, of course, is that Nicola's single-minded independence, independence, independence has led to 10 years of Scottish leadership where everything else hasn't been done. And they have an appalling record on health, on education, on transport, on infrastructure.
Oh, you and I could do a whole show on that. But we do, just on this point of sort of the way Britain treats... the way Britain treats its politicians, I do want to end on the rather unpleasant story of Mike Freer.
Yes, this is a really awful story.
So he is a justice minister. He is the MP for Finchley and Golders Green. And he will not be the MP for Finchley and Golders Green or whatever the reconfigured seat ends up being after the next election.
It's cool. We're still called Finchley and Golders
because,
Green.
Because he's standing down, and he is standing down not because he has been a target of hate attacks and including an arson attack on his constituency office. Indeed, he was a target for the guy, Ali Harbi Ali, who killed Sir David Amos in that terrible attack. So this is how serious we're talking. You know, Mike Free has been an MP for a long time. He is a justice minister. And in an interview with the Daily Mail, in which he announced his departure, he said that actually he had been a campaign to these death threats and intimidation because of his support for Israel. And this... The point is that we don't need to get into the specifics of his case, because there is a very important point about how we treat politicians in the UK. There is a lack of respect for people who want to commit to public life. There is a sort of sense of, like, I don't know, public ownership, where we think we can kick them publicly in certain ways. And this is the most extreme version of it because of how egregious these threats against him, that put his staff at risk, that put his family at risk. No, you know, we cannot live in a politics where this happened, because it is a total threat to democracy, and it puts off the best and the brightest wanting to be MPs and politicians. It is just horrific on multiple levels. We've now seen Sir David Amos and Joe Cox murders. We saw Stephen Timms attacked, and we've now got Mike Freer standing down because he feared he would be next. And was very nearly next.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, there is 100% no excuse for any sort of violence within a democracy. There is no real excuse for abusive behaviours, particularly consistent abuse. I mean, we've all told someone to fuck off every now and again when we've needed to. But
don't,
you know,
tell them about our pre-show meetings. Come on.
But what I mean by that is, I think that we do need to draw a line between, say, I tweeted, "Oh, effing Rishi Sunak, he's such a dickhead," once, or I consistently emailed and tweeted at Rishi Sunak's office 20, 30, 40 times a day, "You're a dickhead, you're a dickhead, you're a dickhead." Those are two different things.
You're certainly right about that. The other thing, of course, is it is often local MPs that get this. You know, Rishi Sunak has security that can look after him. Joe Cox and Sir David Amos did not. Clearly Mike Freer did not until a certain point. I don't know if they've changed that now. You know, we're very lucky in the United Kingdom that our politicians are accessible through surgeries, through the way they walk around and go about their business. We lose that at our peril. You know, American politicians, for example, I think they must all walk around with security and huge entourages and stuff. British politicians do not do that. You know,
no, but they do more and more have to have security measures in their surgeries.
Absolutely.
In their homes. And that's A, going to put people off going into politics, and
yes,
B, makes it a lot harder to have those human contact relationships, which has always been at the heart of British politics.
Absolutely. As I say, we lose that at our peril. It's really, really, we all want our candidate to be the quote unquote community candidate. Well, they can't do that if they've been intimidated to having to have a police officer around them, not being able to go about their business in the constituency normally, and have to be barricaded in their office or their home.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I couldn't agree. I mean,
or you make the surgery less accessible.
What I don't want to do is sound in any way like I don't think we should have robust debate and criticism of
no,
politicians.
It's a different thing. That's not what we're talking about.
We aren't talking about that. We are talking about threats of violence, threats of intimidation, actual intimidation, and
actual violence.
In some cases, actual violence.
I mean, the picture of Freer's office burnt through is horrific.
Yes. And I also want us, again, because the topic of what's happening in the Middle East is so emotive, people are, and a lot of people have one side or the other with whom they are more aligned. I'm trying very, very hard not to find myself in that space because I just find the whole thing horrific. But unfortunately, what's happening is that British Muslims and British Jews, as well as British politicians, are finding themselves as targets of people who have very strong feelings about a conflict that has nothing to do with British Muslims, British Jews, and very little to do with British politicians. And we all need to be really conscious when, as we quite rightly do, discuss the ins and outs and the rights and wrongs and the grey areas of what is happening in Gaza and what has happened in Israel and the ongoing complexities around the relationship between Palestine and Israel.
Just to say, it's not what's happened in Israel. There's still rockets being fired from the north day and day out.
But I think what we're talking about specifically, because there had been rockets fired before that didn't lead to an incursion into Gaza.
No, but it's just not in the past tense is my only point.
But I think that we need to make sure that we can have those conversations. Those conversations have to be had, because if they're not had, they will get bottled up and boil over. But they need to be had without it being a case that you're a Muslim, therefore you are to blame for October the 7th. You're Jewish, therefore you are to blame for the deaths in Gaza. You're a British politician. Why haven't you made sure there's a ceasefire? None of these things are actually within the realms of political possibility at the moment. But we need to make sure that when we have these very important conversations and go through the nuances of what is not happening, the rights and wrongs, what could be done, what should be done, that we do it without that kind of group blaming or fantasy thinking that I think creates the atmosphere in which those who are violent feel more emboldened to act.
I want to return just to these specific attacks because, for example, a group apparently called Muslims Against Crusades, whatever that means, told Mike Freer, "Let Stephen Timms be a warning to you." Apparently, there was something in a North Finchley mosque in which he was referred to as a Jewish homosexual pig. I don't think Mike Freer is Jewish, but anyway, who was defiling the house of Allah. You know, this is just radicalizing and radical kind of approaches that put real people at real risk. And I think my general point actually is we have got to a point where we sort of don't think of politicians as real people. And that's when it becomes very dangerous.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that's as true of, say, Absana Begum, who got a lot of really nastiness this week and has put out a statement about some of that yesterday, as it is about Mike Freer, as it is about, say, Margaret Hodge, who had some of the most horrific anti-Semitic abuse. So I just think we need to take the...
Margaret Hodge is a very good example of someone who was basically meant to be tried to be bullied out of politics.
So, I mean, I think it's just really, really important that we don't make it about one community of MPs, but make it about how we relate to all MPs.
That's exactly my point. Yeah. We don't relate to politicians as other individual humans with friends, families and complexities. And this is what happens. You know, this Daily Mail article, Mike Freer reveals he's attending public events in a stab vest. This is not how British politics can be.
Well, it is how it currently is.
Exactly.
It's not how it should be.
Yeah.
Can is a complicated word there, I suppose.
We can't have Polish politics function in the communal way we all like to think we want it to be if this is what's happening. If you want Mike Freer to stop at the Sainsbury's Inn and chat to you in the Sainsbury's in Golders Green, he can't have that if his life is at risk. If you want Margaret Hodge to be walking the streets in her constituency, you cannot have it if people are threatening their lives. You can name any MP, it doesn't matter. That is the beginning and end of it. If you want to be able to walk into a surgery instead of have to book weeks in advance, you cannot have people diving over the tables and stabbing people.
Well, I mean, I think you can have that whatever you want.
No, but yeah. The nature of our politics is that you can walk into an MP's surgery and engage with them.
Yeah, and it's worth saying that this isn't just MPs who feel threatened and intimidated.
No.
And there are councillors as well.
Less recourse to protection and security resources. Anyway, it's a very depressing space on which to end the show. But sadly, we must end it there because it's one of the big stories of the week. Emma, where can people keep up with you?
I'm on all the social media at EmmaBurnell_, and you can read my newsletter, Hard Thinking on the Soft Left, on Substack.
Head over to theaddition.net to keep up with me. You can read blogs there. You can sign up to my newsletter there. You could also get to my other podcast. But the most important thing you can do to support this show is head over to patreon.com/House of Comments podcast, or just search for Patreon House of Comments. There you can pay a meagre £5 a month, and it will get you extra audio content. It will get you access to the paid tiers of both of our newsletters, which would cost £100 for a year in total if you did it separately. But doing it through Patreon this way, it will cost a mere £60 for the year, which is frankly a bargain. And of course, it helps us try and get one up on those boys doing all the other political podcasts. And it really...
Boring, boring boys. Listen to us instead.
You should listen to us instead. That's absolutely right. And so that would really mean a lot to us. That's House of Comments on Patreon. So hopefully you feel able and willing to do that. And while you're signing up, we'll see you next week.
Oh, and don't forget to rate and review.
Oh yeah, please do rate and review us, because that means everyone can find us as well. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next week.